Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey y'all, I'm Mandy.
And this is Monstrous.
This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering for some. Listener discretion is advised.
All right, we're back. We are in our third week of Black History Month. So far, we've talked about the Red Summer of 1919 and wrongful convictions for Black Americans. And this week, we're going to follow up last week's discussion with a wrongful conviction case that leaves several victims in its wake, along with justice that went unserved for over a decade. It is a very heavy case, but it is a key case for the injustice that people of color in our justice system suffer through. So I want to warn everyone now, this is going to be a heavy one.
Great.
So, I know, this one's going to bring back your, what in the hell?
Oh, shit.
Yep, this one's going to bring it back. So, the case today has people in power that decided who was guilty before they were even proved to be guilty. They wanted the case solved, and they did it, even if they put five innocent boys away. The hysteria was over, and it was done. They set up a story that everyone within the city swallowed up without a second thought. They believed this story would solve a problem, but in fact, it only made it worse. They ruined lives, supported racial stereotypes, and the story they told was not accurate, not even close. So for today's case, we're going back to New York and back to the 80s. During this time, the city was riddled with racism. The racial and socioeconomic tensions were on the rise, even though both were already at a high point. In the 80s, New York was divided. One side was Wall Street, where everyone was getting rich following the stagnation in the 70s. In the 70s and the early 80s, the financial crisis in the city was so bad that New York City itself nearly filed for bankruptcy. Could you imagine an entire city going bankrupt?
Right.
Like a whole city, and New York City at that. That blew my mind. So it was like they had their own little recession going on, basically. It was so bad in some areas like Brooklyn and the Bronx that property owners began burning down their apartment buildings and homes just to collect insurance money.
What?
Yep, that's how bad it got. So after they did this, a large number of people were obviously left homeless, jobless, and broke. So this occurred mostly in Black and Latino neighborhoods. Along with a recession growing throughout the city, unemployment and crime rates were at an all-time high. And because of the city's bankruptcy seeming inevitable, police and firefighters were laid off. Municipal services were cut off, including garbage and other sanitation services, as well as after-school programs. All cut off. So we're in the 70s, in a city crumbling at the knees, and now we have kids whose parents are working and nowhere to go after school, not to mention the fact that Son of Sam was on the loose at the same time. Then came the blackout of 1979. Following the blackout, there were a crazy amount of fires and people looting, just going crazy everywhere. There were abandoned buildings everywhere. None of it was cleaned up. So people think New York looked bad now. In the 70s and 80s, it was even worse. So then in the 80s, suddenly, Wall Street began to boom again and created a massive wealth for a number of people. These people had a normal amount of wealth to us, but for them, especially during that time, they were rich. Then you have the other side of New York that didn't get to see that boom hit. They were in extreme poverty. The crack epidemic is raging through the entire city. Police were understaffed and most were racist and corrupt. This increased the amount of crime. Aside from the normal level of violence, the crack wars hit the city. Then, really young kids were gaining access to guns and a lot of money. And so, as one would expect, all hell eventually broke loose. On a typical day in New York City in 1989, emergency response teams will receive reports of a total of 9 rapes, 5 murders, 255 robberies, and 194 aggravated assaults in one day.
In one day?
Yes. And people wonder why I won't live in a city.
Right.
The people who were victims of these crimes were poor working class members that had fallen through the cracks. And these victims were mostly of Black, Brown, and Latino descent who lived mostly in Bedford-Stuy, Brooklyn, Harlem, Brownsville, and the lower side of New York. So like the lower east side. And on top of all of this, as if this crime wasn't enough, there was a race war growing within the city as well. So for those of you that have yet to figure out the case that I'm talking about today, I'm going to tell you about the Central Park Five and the East Side Rapist. Your fucking eyes. They just got so big. So on Wednesday, April 19th, 1989, at around 9 p.m., about 30 teenagers who lived inside East Harlem went into the most northern side of Central Park. And quite a few of them went on to commit several attacks, assaults, and robberies. Can you imagine, dude, walking into a park for just a nice nighttime stroll and 30 fucking teenagers walk in at once?
Right.
Like, even if they're just there to just swing on the swings or something, no. That's too many teenage hormones at once for me. So anyway, like I said, there were 30 teens inside the park. So it's hard to say exactly how many of them were actually committing those crimes and which ones were just there. But we do, though, that not all of them were committing crimes. The crimes that were committed included attacking bicyclists, some threw rocks at a cab, a man was beaten, robbed, and left unconscious. A teacher who was running in the park was severely beaten. A different jogger was attacked after being hit in the back of the head with a pipe and a stick. Two other men were beaten until they were unconscious, being hit with a metal pipe and stones, punched, and kicked in the head.
Damn.
Yeah. So we have this group of 30 teens inside the park, and an unknown number of them were out here just attacking and beating people for no reason. They, you know, were just out here wilding out, just having a good old time. So while all this is happening, police start getting reports of the different attacks, of course. So they head out to investigate. Once they arrive, at around 10:15 p.m., a few of the kids were arrested, including 14-year-olds Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana Jr. So obviously, these kids are very young, and each of them were charged with mischief. That's how this whole thing started.
Right.
So now we're going to jump ahead to about 1:30 in the morning of Thursday, April 20th. Pastor Baez was walking through the park when he discovered the unconscious body of Trisha Miley in a shallow ravine wearing only her bra. Trisha had decided to go for a run before 9 p.m. on Wednesday night in Central Park, as she normally did. She hadn't been seen or heard from for the next 4 hours. Not until the pastor found her almost lifeless body. She had either been knocked down, dragged, or chased 300 feet from the jogging path and violently assaulted. So here's a trigger warning for everyone, okay? Trisha had been stabbed 5 times. She had been raped, sodomized, and beaten nearly to death. The first officer on scene stated that she was beaten as badly as anyone that he had ever seen. It was so bad that her white shirt, her white running shirt, was no longer white. It was completely soaked in her blood.
Damn.
When it was pulled out at trial, you couldn't tell that shirt was ever white. Yeah. So it was bad.
Right.
It's like she was left nearly dead. So while the discovery of Trisha's body was happening, the kids back at the police station were being released to their parents, being told they had to go to family court, you know, all of that. When an officer had been informed of the discovery of Trisha's body, who then informed the head of the unit. What follows this is hours of intense interrogation, which included tactics to wear these teenagers down, which we all know after our last week's episode, that is how you get a confession, be it true or false. For 42 hours, these teens were wore down. And by the end of the interrogation, they were exhausted. They were given no food, nothing to drink, and they weren't allowed to sleep. Then, to make it worse, they were repeatedly told that they could go home once they confessed to what they had done to Trisha. So, of course, eventually, the kids began to turn on each other. Even though the ones they had arrested, only two of them actually knew the other.
What?
Yep. So at the beginning of this, only two of the boys that are ultimately arrested and charged knew each other. They all just happened to be at the same place, along with 25 other kids. Yep. 42 hours. They sit here. What do you think is going to happen?
Right. They're scared.
Exactly. They're kids. So they're hungry, they're tired, and they just want to go home. So in the end, they told detectives whatever they wanted to hear. Because they are 14 and 15-year-old children. They're scared, and they just want to go home. And the kids they chose weren't bad kids. There's a documentary by Ken Burns and his daughter, which is called The Central Park Five. And I recommend it to anyone that wants to know more about the case. But in a nutshell, this documentary talks about the kids' backgrounds. Each one came from a good home. No one had ever been arrested. They had never been taken into custody. Nothing. They were little league baseball players. One of the boys played cello. It was like the clarinet or something. One of them played basketball. Like, they were the epitome, the pinnacle of good kids.
Right.
Not just this, but there were 30 other kids in the park that night. How can you tell which ones are guilty? The cops showed up and they scattered. They ran. How do you know? So if it doesn't seem like there was any real evidence, any real investigating happening here, right? It's like the slowest kids were the ones that got arrested, even if they were innocent. And one of the biggest issues with it is that no one that was attacked that night, including Trisha, was able to identify any of the boys that were brought into the station. So it's easy to assume that none of these boys had anything to do with the attacks. Or someone would have pointed to them, right?
You would think.
That's where my brain goes. If they did it, someone would have pointed that they did it. None of the victims pointed to any of these five boys for anything. So eventually, the boys, of course, implicate each other in Trisha's assault. After two days of brutal interrogations, they begin to confess. In the boys' written and taped confessions, they said they were accomplices to the rape, but didn't actually participate in it. And they began to tell details of what and how the assault happened. They even implicated three other boys in the attack of Trisha. Okay, so I know I've rinsed all five of them at this point. So remember, initially, Kevin and Raymond were the ones that were initially brought in. All five of the boys were in the park that night. But only two of them had been caught and brought into the station that night, which was Kevin and Raymond. And somehow the police figured that the other three were involved in it. I'm not sure how. I haven't been able to wrap my brain around that one. Even after all the research I've done, I have yet to figure out how they wrapped those three into it. But they did somehow. And that's whenever they start implicating the other three boys.
Right.
Right. So the two they brought in didn't know each other. They didn't know the three they implicated. They got those three names from the police. So that's how they were brought in. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. The way I know how it was, how they, you know, brought him in and all that. But I wanted to make sure that how I said it made sense. Because as it I was did. Saying it, I was starting to confuse myself. Okay, so the three other boys in our case are 16-year-old Corey Wise, 15-year-old Yusef Salam, and 15-year-old Antron McCray. So all young. So they're all brought in for questioning. And from the movie or the documentary that I watched, Corey initially wasn't a suspect. From what I watched, Corey and Yusef were out. They were the two that knew each other. They were out. The police had stopped them. They took Yusef in. They were you can go with your friend. You can go with him, blah, 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 right? So Corey decides to go with him to watch out for Yusef. That's why he went to the park that night. And he wanted to go with him to the police station to look after him. Because Yusef was very intelligent. He was a very smart kid. And for one reason or another, Corey felt the need to look after him. That's how he ended up at the police station. He just went to look out for his friend. And somehow that made him guilty. Yeah, it's not somewhere that my brain can go because it doesn't make any freaking sense to me.
Right.
So by the time the detectives were done interrogating all three boys, two of them had confessed. And so all five were arrested and charged for the attack of Trisha. Once the media caught wind of the arrest, they lost their shit. The attack and the eventual arrest were big news, and this case confirmed what white New Yorkers had believed was wrong within the city, as well as showed the deep-rooted racial prejudice that was present. In the boys' confessions, they had stated that the group was in the park, quote-unquote, wildin'. For any of those that don't know what that means, it is a slang term that was widely used in the 80s and somewhat in the early 2000s as another way to say that they were just, you know, untamed and just out there running amok everywhere. With all this information available, the media ate the story up. And even though minor suspects' names and information are supposed to be withheld from the media and the public, their names were in fact printed. And they didn't stop there either. Media outlets went on to print not only their names, but their addresses and their photos as well.
How can you do that?
I don't know, but they did. And this was all done before the boys were arraigned or were formally indicted on charges. So they were arrested, but they had not been arraigned, and a grand jury had not formally handed down indictments. And they're just plastering this everywhere. So obviously the boys did end up recanting their statements, saying that their confessions had been coerced by intimidation, they had been lied to, all of that. So what do the boys have to prove what they're saying? Do they have anything to show that they were coerced or intimidated? Well, in my opinion, they had a lot. So as we know, their confessions were videotaped, as they normally are. However, there was more to those interrogations that the video recordings did not show. The initial statements of all five boys, the entire 2 days worth of interrogations, and their written statements were all done before the video recording ever turned on. Video proof of any of those does not exist.
Of course not.
The only part of the 2 days worth and hours long interrogations that was recorded and used as evidence were the parts where each boy said that they had taken part in the attack or implicated someone else. And to make that worse, it was only recorded once each of the boys knew the case details and had their stories down pat. Detectives didn't record how they had the boys tell them what happened 500 different times. How the boys would tell them a story and the detectives responded with, quote, "That's not what happened." Or lastly, how they had led them to tell the right story of the events of that night.
That's insane.
Yep. So meanwhile, back at the hospital, Trisha's injuries are so bad that she is given her last rites. So for anyone that doesn't know what that is, it is a religious practice when someone is dying to be given a last prayer or other rituals depending on their own religious beliefs. So her injuries are so bad that those around her believe she's going to die. But after being in a coma for 12 days, Trisha wakes up and eventually she is able to talk, read, and walk again. However, she has no memory of the night of her attack at all. So now we're going to move forward to the trial because between this is, you know, normal legal stuff, all that stuff that happens when you have a big trial like this. So we're going to go ahead and jump forward to the trial itself. So usually homicide detectives would be the ones to head the case like this. But since Trisha woke up and survived her attack, the case is given to Linda Fairstein, the head of the sex unit crimes. And the sex crimes prosecutor, Elizabeth Ledier, I believe is how you say it. For some reason, these two were a part of the case from day one. Okay. So it's not unusual for the head of a unit or the prosecutors to be updated as an investigation progresses, but they were involved in the actual investigation. They helped investigate doing things like analyzing the crime scene, collecting evidence, literally everything from the very beginning. And one of them in particular from day one had a belief that these five boys were the ones that committed the crime. And she built her case around it. Obviously, this is not normal. Okay? Prosecutors being involved in a case where they themselves investigate can skew the results and lead it into the direction that they want it to go. The prosecutors and defense attorneys typically don't get the full results of an investigation until it's complete. But she knew what was going on, every single detail from the very beginning. And she made the whole thing fit her narrative. If all of that makes sense.
Yes.
I kind of ramble sometimes. So, the boys are taking a trial. The papers are going fucking nuts, obviously. Because, you know, here was a white woman who had been attacked by what the state said was a group of rowdy black boys. Which, okay, pause. I have two boys. You have a boy. Our kids are obviously white. They're fucking rowdy.
Yeah.
The fact that these five boys were black don't have nothing to do with it. They're boys. Boys are rowdy. It's normal. If you don't have a rowdy boy, then I'm going to have concern for your child. It's in their DNA or something. So this, of course, stirred up the racism in the city. The racial divide was very clear, and it only made it worse. And it was not something that anybody talked about. It was just kind of there. Everyone knew about it, but we didn't talk about it. This case gave them something to point at. Something for every racist person to say was the reason for that racial divide. To explain exactly how big this case was, I'm going to tell you about a few other things that were going on at the exact same time that no one knows of. The same night of Trisha's attack, another woman in Bedford Stuy, which is a neighborhood inside Brooklyn, New York, was raped and then thrown off of a building. It was never mentioned in the media anywhere. Yep. I wish all of you could see Mandy's face. Yep. In the same week that the Central Park 5 case happened, a total of 28 rapes were reported, but not one of them appeared in the media.
Make that make sense.
Exactly. Yep. So they just decided, oh, we're going to go with this one because it's 5 teenage boys. I'm not minimizing what happened to Trisha in any way. She went through something horrific, something no one should ever go through. She nearly lost her life. She doesn't remember what happened to her. But these boys were victims also.
Right.
Just in a different way. So sadly, these boys didn't just have to fight against the white community. The black community itself was divided on whether they believed that the boys were guilty or not. Some of them had had their own run-in with the black youth who had assaulted and intimidated them in their very own neighborhoods. And with the reputation that their neighborhoods had as being full of nothing but drug dealers and felons, these five boys, no matter how good they were doomed from the very beginning. So during the trial, all the evidence is pulled out. Juries walk through it all, or rather, should I say, lack of evidence. There was DNA found, and it was tested, but it didn't match any of the boys.
What?
Yeah. Detectives didn't find any hair or any other physical evidence that is connected any of the boys to the attack of Trisha. All they had was DNA, and it didn't match any of them. Then they showed the crime scene photos. These didn't fit their narrative either. The photos didn't show five separate people attacking someone. The photos looked as though one single person had attacked someone else. So I'm going to try to paint a picture for you because I couldn't find one. So there's a main road, right, that goes through the park. That's like the main jogging park where people ride their bikes, you know, all of that. Then there's like this little tiny, like small path that just kind of veers off. You know how they have on walking trails?
Mm-hmm.
That leads down into like a little ravine. Kind of like, oh, I'm going to go over here and just see the water really fast and then come back kind of thing. There's no outlet. Trisha was found at the bottom of that little path where the ravine was. The photos didn't show a big scuffle there or on the road. It didn't show several feet prints or anything that would point to more than one attacker. It literally looked as if someone had walked either up behind Trisha and attacked her from behind and then drug her down the path and then walked back up it after attacking her. Or they walked up the path, attacked her, drug her down the path, and then walked back up and just went on about their merry way. That's what the photos look like. It doesn't look like there were six different people there scuffling around. And it damn sure doesn't look like there were five teenage boys attacking one person. There would be multiple feet prints. There would be broken branches and like there would be evidence of that. There was none. So how they got five people did this, I don't have a clue. When the boys were brought in to be interrogated, which, to remind everyone, two of these boys were arrested at the park. So there was no time for them to go home, to change, or clean themselves up, right? So if they did this attack, those two boys, based off of how much blood there was and how brutal the attack was, they would have been covered in at very minimum. They would have been covered in Trisha's blood, right?
Right.
When they were brought in, they had no mud, no dirt, no blood, nothing. Not even on their shoes. Not only that, investigators said Trisha had fought for her life, that she fought hard against whoever it was that had attacked her. And whoever did it definitely would have had some kind of marks on them. And only one of the boys had a scratch near his eye. Do you want to know where that scratch came from?
What?
When an officer, and it was Kevin. Kevin, his eye was swollen. He had a scratch right here under his eye. That came when an officer tackled him. And as Kevin is telling him he didn't do anything, he hit him in the face with his helmet. That's
where that wasn't even from the crime.
Nope. And one of the other boys who was hiding, one of the other Central Park Five boys, he seen it because he was hiding behind a tree and he seen the officer hit Kevin in the face with his helmet.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So like I said before, there was DNA found on Trisha, right? And they ran it. Did match. There was also DNA found under her nails. Did match. There was DNA literally all over her. On her clothes, her, everywhere at the scene. They even found a sock that had semen in it. Or, well, either in it or on it. Not sure which one because it's been reported both ways. None of that DNA matched any of these boys.
That's wild.
Do you want to know how the prosecution explained that?
How?
There was a sixth boy that they just hadn't caught. And that's whose DNA it belonged to. Mind you, again, this person would have been completely covered in Trisha's blood. Nobody seen this guy. So the trial was full of nothing but false confessions and loose circumstantial evidence, mind you. Extremely loose. The judge on this case was Thomas Galligan, who 9 times out of 10 sided with the state and often sent convicted criminals to none other than Rikers Island. The island was nicknamed Galligan's Island because he sent so many inmates there. Typically, cases are rotated through judges. That way, there's a smaller chance of bias, right? That didn't happen here. This case was handed directly to Galligan. And it was done so to keep the state from losing their case because it was so weak.
That's sad.
All 5 boys' cases were split into 2 trials. He was the judge on both. So the first trial was against 15-year-old Yusef Salam, 15-year-old Antron McCray, and 14-year-old Raymond Santana Jr. These 3 were offered a plea deal, but they refused to accept it. They said they didn't do it, and they wouldn't plead to something they didn't do. The second trial was against 14-year-old Kevin Richardson and 16-year-old Corey Wise. Despite the fact of any real evidence in either trial, that's including the lack of DNA match from the semen sample or any of the DNA, the false confessions of all 5 boys, the conflicting testimonies of detectives on the stand. So the detectives didn't even have their fucking story straight. No positive IDs made either within the days of the attack or in court. Kevin, Yusef, Antron, and Raymond were all convicted of the rape, assault, and attempted murder of Trisha, as well as the robberies, the rioting, and the other attacks committed that night. And they all got the maximum sentence allowed for juveniles, which was 5 to 10 years. Kevin served 5.5 of those years. Yusef served 6 years and 8 months. Antron served 6 of those. Raymond, like Kevin, served his entire 5-year sentence. Each of these 4 boys served nearly their entire sentences in juvenile hall. Once they aged out, they were moved to adult prison. But because they were so young, they didn't spend much time in adult prison. Corey Wise is a completely different story. He was the only one to be tried as an adult, even though all of them could have been tried as either adults or juveniles because they were all over the age of 13 at the time. He was sentenced to 5 to 15 years. And where do you think he was originally sent to?
Rikers Island.
Yep. They sent a 16-year-old child to fucking Rikers Island.
That's bullshit.
So for anyone that doesn't know, Rikers Island is an extremely dangerous and very inhumane jail complex. There's more than one jail on the island. So before I continue with the case, I'm going to give a little insight into why the fact that they sent him there is just barbaric and an abuse of power. Okay. Rikers Island is 413 acres. It was opened in 1932. It has been described as hell and called Torture Island. Intake areas are jammed full of new inmates. Toilets don't work, sinks don't work, and the new inmates could spend weeks in this tiny room. There is no recreation time, no healthcare available because they can't get inmates to their appointments, along with missed court appointments. The violence on this island is through the roof because correctional officers are slim in numbers. A previous inmate of Rikers Island, who was there due to his own wrongful conviction, stated that the island isn't ran by the COs. It's run by the inmates. Nearly every person on Rikers Island is awaiting trial. A previous warden of Rikers stated that nearly every person that has ever been to Rikers leaves worse than they went in as.
Holy shit.
Yep. He says it's you leave way worse than you were when you got there. So, abuse, death, and misconduct run rampant through the jails on the island. In any given year, 1,500 officers that work on the island are assaulted. Basically, Rikers is an island where the city puts people that they don't want to deal with. The ones they want hidden away and forgotten about. And they leave them all just to rot and kill each other. The city of New York being able to just throw inmates, be it guilty or not, onto this island and forget about them is coming to an end, though. In October of 2019, New York City's council announced that they plan to close Rikers Island jail system by 2026. So I guess there's some kind of hope we can hold on to there, I guess. Eye roll. For anyone right. That can't fucking see us. So, just from that small snippet, you can see why sending Corey here, who is now a convicted rapist of a white woman, was dangerous and detrimental. Before I move on to how the case ends, I want to tell you how difficult things were for Corey in prison. Obviously, it was hard on all five of them, because they were all children. They were wrongfully convicted. They came from good families and ultimately ended up growing up imprisoned. But for Corey, the experience was way worse. As I just told you, Corey had started out in Rikers. While he was here, he was attacked while guards stood by and let it happen. Following this, another inmate told Corey that he could request a transfer. All he had to do was ask for help in the law library. This attack had landed Corey in the infirmary, and after giving the guard that stood by and watched this attack happen candy bars from his very own commissary, he told Corey next time to request solitary because, quote, the infirmary is for snitches. So Corey decides to put in for a transfer. And although he was only there for about a year, his time was hard. And after he left Rikers, things didn't get any better. In 1991, Corey was transferred to Attica Prison. While here, he was attacked and severely beaten. He remembered what the CO from Rikers had told him. So instead of going to the infirmary, he requested solitary confinement, where he spent the entire 2 years that he was in Attica. He got close to a guard who was named CO Roberts, and he tried to make Corey's time there easier. He gave him magazines, a chia pet, because Corey had mentioned wanting to get one once he got out, and even got him a job cleaning the day room, bathrooms, and cafeteria to get him time out of solitary. Corey had grew fond of Roberts and at one point asked him why he was so nice to him. Roberts' response was that he himself had a son, and if what happened to Corey happened to his son, he would want to know that someone was treating him like a human. Corey had no one to look out for him while in prison, and it seemed as though he had finally had someone that cared about his well-being, but that wouldn't last long. After a visit from his mom, he realized how much he missed her, how hard traveling that far was for her, because Attica Prison was 347 miles from Harlem, which is where they lived. And so he promised to do what he could to get moved closer. So he put in another transfer. I want to note here an important name to remember. Okay. While in Attica, Corey met an 18-year-old named Matias Reyes when the two had gotten into a scuffle over the volume of the day room TV while Corey was cleaning the bathrooms and listening to the music that was being played on BET at the time. Do you remember BET?
I do.
I loved BET.
Me too.
Loved it. Now it's just, it's shit. That was damn reality TV shows all the time. Not like what it used to be. Okay, so that's all I'm going to tell you about Matias for now. Okay, but remember his name. He's important. So now moving back to Corey. In 1993, Corey's second transfer request was approved. But rather than being moved closer to his mom, he was transferred even farther from home to Windy State Prison, which is 366 miles from Harlem. Shortly after arriving, Corey again was attacked. He yelled for a guard who pried his hands off the bars and walked away.
That's so sad.
This attack nearly cost Corey his life. The doctors didn't think he would be able to walk or do anything again without pain. A month later, he proved them wrong. It was later revealed, after Wendy C.O. Starks had spoke to Corey, that he himself had orchestrated the attack.
Pathetic.
Yeah. He said that he had orchestrated the attack because in his prison, they didn't have celebrities. Yeah. So once again, Corey chose to stay in solitary confinement in order to protect himself. In 2001, Corey was transferred for a third time to Auburn Prison. And it seems as though Corey had an easier time here than he did before. I mean, by this time, Corey was 29 years old and he had been in prison for 13 years. So it's safe to say that he had kind of learned the ropes by the time he was sent to Auburn. This is where Matias Reyes comes back into our case. While in the yard, their paths cross again. It doesn't seem like Corey really had much of an idea of who Reyes was at first, not until Reyes had reminded him of Attica. But Matias knew exactly who Corey was from the first time he laid eyes on him. Okay, so how does Matias Reyes fit into our case and what does he have to do with the boys, right? Do you know who this is?
He's the one that did it.
Do you, like, have any idea about his name or anything? Have you ever heard his name?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to tell you. During the same summer that Trisha was attacked, so the summer of 1989, there was a single rapist that was terrorizing the Upper East Side, and he was dubbed the East Side Rapist. On August 15th, 1989, 18-year-old Matias Reyes is caught after raping a woman. So what does he have to do with the Central Park Five? Matias was born in Puerto Rico in 1971 and moved with his mother to New York as a child. He had a low IQ and was described as emotionally disturbed, which aren't they all?
Right.
I feel like that's an obvious. He had told psychiatrists later that as a small child, he'd been sexually assaulted, but there was no proof of that, so it's hard to say if it did or did not happen, and if that is what led him in the direction that he went or not. In 1989, he worked as a deli clerk in Upper Manhattan and was said to be a loner. other than that, I couldn't really find much about his life. So Matias's first known attempted rape was committed in 1988 when he threatened 27-year-old Jackie Herbeck with a knife at her church just east of Central Park. And she had somehow been able to convince him not to rape her. The next known attack is the attack that got him arrested. On April 17th, Reyes beat and began to rape a 26-year-old unidentified woman in northern Central Park. But he ran away when a passerby had interrupted. She told detectives that the man who raped her had fresh stitches on his chin. And after the detective assigned to the case checked into local medical centers, he was able to identify her attacker as Matias Reyes. This woman left the city shortly after her attack. The detective was transferred from the sex unit and the case went cold. Like, we dropped the ball on that one, didn't we?
Right.
Following this, a year-long reign of terror fell over New York. Five more women were assaulted in the following months. Two more attempted rapes took place, one murder, and the quadruple murder of Lourdes Gonzalez, who was pregnant, along with her three other children who heard their mother's attack through the bedroom walls. On August 5th, 1989, Reyes attacked his final victim. He crept into this woman's 91st Street apartment and raped her. She had managed to get away from him and run for help. One of her neighbors and her building's doorman had apprehended Reyes until the police arrived and arrested him. He was quickly identified as the East Side Rapist. And he confessed to those crimes along with the DNA match. It was a slam dunk. Reyes took a plea deal where he agreed to serve 33 years to life in prison. At his 1991 sentencing, he punched his lawyer and had to be carried out by the guards. Then the judge recommended that he be imprisoned for life. Clearly, this motherfucker can't control himself. And here, we're back to where I left off with Corey.
Mm-hmm.
By the time their paths had crossed for the second time in Auburn, Reyes had found God. Don't they fucking all?
Of course.
Yeah. All of a sudden, here he is. And he began to feel guilty for the fact that Corey was serving his time. And so, in 2002, he came forward, confessing to the attack on Trisha in 1989.
He did it.
Yep. He went into detail about how he followed, raped, and beat Trisha, giving details that the Central Park Five never got right. He knew exactly where Trisha's house keys had been thrown and why, along with her socks, which were things that the detectives could never figure out. Why were her house keys thrown way over here? According to Reyes, he threw them because he was angry that she wouldn't give him her address.
What the hell?
Yep. He knew what she had been wearing, that she had a Walkman, which had been stolen. And the detectives never knew she had a Walkman because it wasn't there, because Reyes had took it. Her friends confirmed that when they told detectives, she always ran with one. She never went running without her Walkman. To confirm this claim, because they didn't believe him. Of course they didn't. They had five young kids that they put away for it. They tested the DNA found on Trisha and at the scene. And it was a match. Trisha was now among the victims of the East Side Rapist. So are you ready for me to make you even madder than you are right now?
Oh, great.
I'll give you a minute to prepare yourself. All right. The worst fact in this entire case is that the East Side Rapist cases that Reyes had admitted to in August of 1989 and the Central Park jogger case all had the same detectives, the same judge, and the same team of prosecutors. But not one of them made a connection between the cases, even though the MOs were the same.
Are you kidding me?
Nope.
That's bullshit.
The detective who took the statement from Reyes when he admitted to the attack on Trisha said that in more than 20 years of investigating homicides, Matias was one of the top five lunatics that he had ever interviewed. So three of the boys who were now adults were already released from prison before Reyes confessed because their time was up. But they were struggling. They were out. They were on the streets. But they were convicted sex offenders and on the sex registry. So life was not easy on the outside either.
Right.
Unfortunately, Raymond Santana Jr. was still in jail for drug charges because following his release, he had taken to selling drugs because he couldn't find a job with a sex crime conviction on his record. And because of his prior conviction, his drug charge was longer than it normally would have been. In the wake of this new evidence, Raymond was released immediately. In 2002, Manhattan's district attorney, Robert Morgenthau, I believe that's how you say it, had all five convictions thrown out, which means they were all overturned. They were officially declared innocent. So the five now men are now dubbed the Exonerated Five. They reached a civil rights settlement with the city of New York in 2014. You want to guess how much their settlement was?
Oh, I can't believe it's got to be outrageous.
New York City settled the civil rights lawsuit for $41 million. She's currently just staring at me, guys.
That's all they got?
That's about $8.2 million for each of them. Of course, that's nowhere close to what they deserve for the hell that they were put through for over a decade. But it is a shit ton of fucking money.
Right.
That is a major we fucked up. In 2016, the men received another settlement from New York State's Court of Claims for $3.9 million, giving each of them a running total of $8,980,000. That is the largest settlement in New York State history. So the prosecutor on the boys' case, Linda Fairstein, refuses to admit that they were wrong, despite the confession and the DNA evidence.
How the hell?
She still says there was a sixth man, and that was Matias.
That's ridiculous.
Yep. By the time 2002 rolled around, Linda was on the board of trustees at Vassar College, which she had graduated from. She had wrote several crime novels. She had basically built her career on this case. After Netflix released their mini-series on the case called When They See Us, a student who had seen the show started a petition to have Linda removed from the board. After the school did nothing, this student made a change.org petition and it quickly blew up. It gained nearly 23,000 signatures, with everyone outraged and calling for the removal of Linda. That included alumni that she graduated with, parents, current board members, literally everyone was outraged, especially after Linda publicly stated that the case was handled correctly, with respect, and it was dignified.
What a piece of shit.
Like, just admit you were wrong and you fucked up and made a mistake.
Right.
Don't double down and say, oh, this was handled correctly. They are guilty. It was proven that they weren't. You sent five innocent children to prison where they had to grow up. Own that shit, girl, because you fucked up big time.
Right.
So following this, the college responded swiftly. The board met about the petition and the student concerns, the alumni surge, concerns, the outrage, all of that. The following week, President Bradley issued a statement saying that Linda Fairstein had resigned from her place on the Board of Trustees.
Good.
Sadly, she isn't the only one that has not admitted they were wrong. There are still today several police officers and detectives that refuse to admit that they were wrong in this case. Okay, so what happened to Trisha? Well, she underwent 5 months of rehabilitation, and following this, she returned to running in Central Park. In 1995, she ran the New York City Marathon and again ran it in 2003. Up until 2003, no one knew she was the woman the exonerated five were accused of attacking. Not until her memoir called I Am the Central Park Jogger was released. Following this, she began a career as an inspirational speaker. She now works with sexual assault victims and brain injuries in the Mount Shy Sexual Assault and Violence Intervention Group. Today, the exonerated five are living their lives and fighting for justice and to end the forces that caused what happened to them. Yousef Salaam is now a married father of 10. In 2016, he received a Lifetime Achievement Award from then President Obama. In 2021, he published a memoir called Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. He has called for prison reform since his release. In 2023, he was elected to represent Harlem on the New York City Council and took office January 1st of 2024. Corey Wise is the only one still living in New York. He has worked with the Innocent Project and advocates for the rights of those wrongfully convicted, as well as for the reform of the criminal justice system. In 2015, Corey founded the Corey Wise Innocence Project at Colorado Law School, where he also offers pro bono legal counsel for those that have been wrongfully convicted. Kevin Richardson is now a father to two daughters and also works for the Innocence Project. He advocates for the rights of those that have been wrongfully convicted. Raymond Santana Jr. lives in Atlanta with his daughter. He has went on to create the Park Madison NYC clothing line, which came out in 2018. That following year in 2019, his clothing line released the Brotherhood T-shirts, which has each of the boys' names on it. And part of the earning from each shirt is donated to the Innocence Project. Antron McCray is now living down south, and he's lived a pretty quiet life with his six children. In December of 2022, the Central Park entrance was renamed Gate of the Exonerated in honor of the five men who had their lives changed forever as just young boys. I want to end our case today with a quote from Raymond Santana Jr. I implore everyone to take this to heart and to remember it in everything you do. Quote, your truth is the foundation your legacy will be built on. And that is the Exonerated Five, also known as the Central Park Five.
The case is crazy.
So what'd you think? Did I do it any justice? Was it good?
Yeah, it was good, but it's insane that they went through all that.
Yep. Like, I knew the case. Obviously, it was a big case. It's a huge one. But I didn't know it to, like, that detail.
Right.
It's hard to cover cases like this. Because you don't want to word something incorrectly or sound insensitive. Because these cases and topics like this can be very loaded. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I really try to dive into them without making, you know, generalizations or... like, I'm being insensitive in any kind of way, because obviously I'm not. But they are important. They should be talked about. And, you know, there's more than one victim in cases like this. There's the victim that the crime happened to, their families. But then there's also the wrongfully convicted, because they're victims in this as well. You know, these boys specifically had their entire lives taken over something they didn't do. They're victims. Their families are victims. Like, you know, their families had hard times finding jobs. They lost their jobs. They had a lot happen to them simply because their boys were accused of something they didn't do.
Right.
So I haven't read any of the memoirs that I mentioned, but I'm going to. I did watch the 4-part Netflix miniseries, which I highly recommend. I got a lot of my information from there. The show has a great cast that includes the late Michael K. Williams, John Leguizamo, I think that's how you say it, Nancy Nash, Felisa, Felicity Huffman, Famke Janssen, Joshua Jackson, who is also known for his role in Dawson's Creek, and more. So from the series, the prosecutor was hell-bent on getting these boys for the assault on Trisha. Based on a map and a few sticky notes, she had been able to make a connection between all the crimes committed in the park that night and these boys. She sent officers on a witch hunt, stopping every black boy they saw on the street to bring in every one of them that was in the park that night. The series goes on to show how the prosecutors and the detectives took advantage of the fact that their parents were not there to advocate for them. Raymond's grandma was there, but she didn't speak English. And so because of that, they took advantage of it and were able to get her out of the interrogation room so they could get what they wanted out of him. Antron's parents were with him, and after openly accusing him, they seemed to push his mother out of the room, and his father was just in shock and scared because a detective had later on threatened him and told him that he needed to talk sense into his kid, implying that the detective would inform Antron's father's boss about an old charge that he did time for. The timeline wasn't right, but in the end, they made the timeline fit their narrative. They perp walked each of the boys and everything, literally had media all lined up as they walked them out.
And that's sad.
Yeah, these children, and they perp walk them like they're these awful monsters. There were so many people in this case that could have stood up and said something to someone, but no one did. They all stood by and allowed this injustice to happen to these boys and Trisha's loved ones to live for over a decade believing that these boys had killed her. Each one of them had been victimized over and over again. Throughout this entire case, they had manipulated everyone. The boys, their families, the judge, jury, and the public. So I highly recommend that everyone watch this series because I kind of gave you like a little bit of a rundown. But there's so much more in there. It really puts you into it, if that makes sense. It shows how dirty the justice system can really be. I think they did a great job capturing the emotions of the case, telling the story as a whole. It's just really good. So I'll link it in the episode description so everyone can find it, so you can watch it if you want to. I'll send it to you, Mandy.
Okay.
Because I know you want to watch it.
Yeah, I do want to see it.
It's so good. I'm also going to link the website for the Innocent Projects by State, just like I did last week. And I'm also going to put in some links for Corey's Innocent Project that he founded. I have several of those that I'm going to put in there. So if anybody wants to go check any of that out or watch the show or, you know, any of that, it'll be right there. You can easily find it. Whew, and that's all I got for this one.
That was a good one.
Thank you. All right. Any final thoughts or anything?
No, that was crazy.
Told you this was a heavy one.
Yeah, most definitely.
Yep. Anyway. All right, so we'll be back next week for our last episode of Black History Month. As always, our sources and photos can be found on our Facebook page. That link is in our episode description. Make sure you give us a rate and a review. Please don't forget to subscribe so you get notifications when our new episodes air. We hope you keep listening. And remember to
watch for monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.